The Judiciary Subcommittee on Civil Law and Judicial Administration. Today's agenda includes House Bill 3195, House Bill 2562, House Bill 2458, House Bill 2219, House Bill 2342, House Bill 2276, House Bill 2164, House Bill 3287, House Bill 2264, House Bill 2529. What I would like to do and is follow our kind of normal format here, and we have all kinds of people with the name honorable before their title, the title honorable before their name. So I'm going to very arbitrarily. I like to get rid of those people as soon as possible. So if not, Representative Campbell, what are you here on? Yes, Representative Campbell, why don't you handle 3195, and then we'll move on to the other honorables. And
thank you very much.
There. Representative Campbell.
Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Representative Larry Campbell, District 43, Lane County. I appreciate very much your taking the time to hear this bill. And before I start to talk about the bill, I want to say that it's with great pleasure I bring this bill with the agreement and support of the Oregon Bar Association, who is represented at the table with me today. And before you today is a bill dealing with ownership of real property. House Bill 3195 would place in statutes the current common law doctrines of adverse possession. I have with me today some people from my district who have personally felt the effects of adverse possession doctrine. And they will share their experiences with you. And I also want to mention from a time standpoint, we had some 20 folks who have volunteered to testify on this and basically have invited Grace Biggs to represent that group, even though they're from wide portions of the state. Also, not being an attorney, I've asked a good friend of mine, who's become a good friend as we've worked through the details of trying to get this bill so the Oregon Bar Association would accept it, Gene Grant. Gene is chairman of the Real Estate and Land Use Section of the Oregon State Bar, and he can provide you with a more technical explanation of the bill than I could possibly give you. I got involved with adverse possession during my first days as a legislator. I quickly became aware of a problem that my constituents were having with people who purposely, using adverse possession, took land, title from them, and land that didn't really belong to them. Let me provide you with some background information on adverse possession. Its roots go back to history to the time when it was used to promote land usage. During this time, the common law was being made, the methods for surveying land and recording land deeds was primitive. Back then, the primary method of proving land ownership was the fact that you were the occupant. However, with accurate land surveying methods and land title recording systems in place, the original doctrine no longer serves that purpose. I now would like to ask Grace Biggs to share her experience with you regarding adverse possession. It's just one example, as I said, of many that we've found around the state since we've taken an interest in this. Following Grace, we'll ask Gene Grant to follow with his explanations of the provisions of the bill. So, Grace, if you'd go ahead with your testimony. Tell them who you are.
I'm Grace Biggs. I live in Crow, near Vinita, on the small farm, 5 acres. We did have 5.5 acres until the half acre was taken away from us by adverse possession by a neighbor. I want to thank you for the opportunity to lend my support to House Bill 3195, establishing the statutory criteria for adverse possession. There were quite a few people that wanted to testify, but there's a big affair going on down there in Vinita tonight, and quite a few of them are involved. It's a awards night for the whole community. Woman of the Year, Man of the Year, and the Grange people. Many people in Oregon whom I have contacted have suffered the loss or threat of loss of real property unjustly in being unaware of the common law allowing them to be deprived of their rights by intimidation and threats of legal action. In our case in 1982, we lost half an acre The adjoining parcel lost 1 acre of timbered land from their 4 acres. And by the way, he's a quadriplegic that from the Vietnam War, and he doesn't get around that well, you know, to be onto his property all the time. But it was an acre of timber, and he was waiting for that to mature so he could harvest it. And 2 other property owners adjoining lost less. We felt so sure that our legal description and recent survey, agreeing with 2 former surveys, were correct and binding and would affirm our contention that we were the legal owners. In addition, our taxes were paid on a similar description of property in the Lane County Assessor's Office. We were ignorant of this common law, and our lawyer was vague when questioned. Only on the very morning of our 2-day trial, several times scheduled and canceled, did he hand us copies of previous cases in which all the defendants retained their properties. These cases gave us hope, though we did not understand the terms. For instance, our neighbor did not appear hostile, we thought. The plaintiffs claiming adverse possession knew the tricks and terms to use in court, and their witnesses were well rehearsed. Our lawyer advised us just to tell the truth, but simple truth was not enough. The fact was never mentioned that all our deeds agreed that the boundary was a quarter section line running east from the established quarter section post, as recorded in the assessor's office where we paid our taxes. And further, no compensation was allowed us for our loss. The government compensates for eminent domain when they take over. In fact, the county pointed out to us that on our southern part of our property, there was the county road had edged in toward our land because of a creek that ran next to it. He asked if we would consider selling the county that little piece of land. Now, they could have taken it over by adverse possession, but they did pay us for that. This statutory bill, HB 3195, on adverse possession, will help to clarify the criteria over the present open-ended common law, which has subjected Oregon citizens to unreasonable expense and trauma in defending what should be their civil rights. Thank you for your attention in this matter. Sincerely, Grace Biggs.
Thank you.
My name is Eugene Grant. I'm a partner in the law firm of Schwabe Williamson and Wyatt, and I'm the chair of the real estate and land use section of the Oregon State Bar. And I'm here officially representing the that section of the bar. The House Bill 3195, if adopted, would restore the concepts of equity and good faith to the doctrine of adverse possession in the state of Oregon. Originally, when the doctrine developed, the requirement of good faith was a part of the elements to obtain adverse possession. The courts in some states, by their decisions, have essentially interpreted away that good faith requirement. That requirement has been embodied in the element known as the hostile possession of the property. And to hostily possess the property, you either have to have what is known as claim of right or color of title. And the claim of right originally was considered to mean essentially the belief or claim that you are the owner of the property. And it had to be a good faith belief. The color of title was very similar, but it was a belief or a reliance placed on a conveyance of the property that for some reason was defective. In other words, a party conveyed a deed to you, but they really weren't the owner of the property. So in either case, the individual claiming adverse possession would have a good faith, honest belief they were the owner of the property. In the case of Nedry v. Morgan, the Oregon Supreme Court essentially interpreted away this requirement, and I've given you a quotation in my written testimony from that case. It starts at the bottom of the first page, where they very clearly stated that it made no difference whether the person had knowledge of an outstanding superior interest in the property. Their knowledge that they were not the owner of the property would make no difference so long as their intent was to actually obtain title to the property through their possession. Now, what this means in plain terms is that a mere trespasser or squatter in Oregon would be able to obtain title to property, and that was never really the intent of the principle of adverse possession, and particularly in this day and age where we have modern surveying, the ownership is settled and we're past the original settlement stage, that kind of principle just doesn't make sense. I've cited here and quoted one of the most respected commentators on real property law who stated that the theory of the requirement of a claim of right is in part to bar mere squatters from the benefits of adverse possession. And this is the significant change that the bill would make from the common law. It's to restore this principle of fairness and equity. Now, that change, if you want to look at the bill, occurs in Section 1, Sub B, where it says that at the time the person claiming by adverse possession entered into possession of the property, the person had the honest belief that the person was the actual owner. That would be a restoration of this good faith standard. Now, Section 2 of the bill is...
Chair, before you go to Section 2, can I ask you one other question, though, about Section 1? You're saying a restoration of the good faith. You're talking about a restoration back to case law in this country. You're not talking about...
Right, that's right. Many states, their court decisions have upheld a requirement of a true, honest belief of ownership requirement. And some states have adopted statutes very similar to what's being proposed here, because in those states like ours, the courts have sort of strayed away and interpreted out the requirement of good faith belief that the person is the owner. Section 2 of the bill would create what is best characterized as an innocent trespasser defense. And it's somewhat of a trade-off for tightening up the doctrine of adverse possession. If we're making it a little harder to gain adverse possession, we're also saying to the person who wrongfully possesses, who trespasses, we're saying as long as you had an honest belief that you owned the property and it was just by mistake, and you didn't really intend to trespass, that you will not be liable for certain damages caused to the property. So there's a trade-off there. And that, again, I think incorporates a basic fairness principle that if a person honestly thought they were the owner of the property, they shouldn't be liable for damages. The last section of the bill is a little more technical and involves the principle of adverse possession when it applies to a co-tenancy situation. There is a statute already on the books, ORS 105.615, that deals with this, and this was the subject of this Nedry v. Morgan case. And in that case, the Supreme Court construed that statute very strictly, or very narrowly. And the purpose of Section 3 is to make clear that that statute is an independent means of obtaining adverse possession. The court said that you had to satisfy the requirements of that statute as well as all the other requirements of the common law doctrine of adverse possession, which as a result makes it almost impossible to use the statute. And there have been a number of members of the bar who have requested our section to sponsor legislation that would amend that statute so that it would be usable in the very common situation where you have a large number of heirs that inherit under a will, and then some of those are missing heirs that you cannot locate, and the statute requires giving of a notice to obtain adverse possession. Well, if you have a large number of missing heirs, it usually is impossible to find them. It's very expensive if you can find them, and so it renders this statute useless in the most common situation where it's very beneficial to settle title to property where somebody left a will to a large number of heirs. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Our
Madam Chair, just one comment that I'd make, and that is that if the committee feels it necessary, we can provide testimony from at least 20 other sources regarding the problems that come from our present adverse possession situation, but we did not want to take the time of the committee today to make those presentations.
I appreciate you having them available, but not immediately available, Representative Campbell. Are there questions, Representative Mannix?
I have a question about a technical matter, so I'll probably direct it to counsel. Section 1 says, this is line 4, page 1, a person may acquire a fee simple title of real property by adverse possession only if, so already we've made it exclusive.
That's right. That is the intent.
Secondly, in line 6, it says the person or the predecessor in interest of the person. I'm looking at this as a litigator might. It sounds to me like you've got this in the disjunctive. What if someone's been there for 5 years and then someone else who is a successor in interest is there for 5 years? Are you saying you want it in disjunctive?
We intend that this codify the existing principle of tacking, which means that the present possessor would be able to tack on the 5 years of the predecessor.
Shouldn't you say the person and the predecessor in interest of the person?
Yes, I think you're probably right. That's a good point.
And shouldn't we say predecessors, because there may have been two or three?
That's
tackees or whatever we would call
good,
them.
Good point.
Madam Chair, Representative Mannix, I'd like to point out that this is one of the many compromises I had to make in order to get the support of the Oregon Bar Association for this issue.
Well, we can clarify that in work session.
Right.
Thank you.
Other questions for any of the witnesses? Thank you very
much.
Thank
you very much.
Representative Mannix is really a question for you. Are there any other witnesses here today to testify on House Bill 3195? Close the public hearing on House Bill 3195. I'm sorry, we'll reopen the public hearing on 3195.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, I should have said no, that I'm not here for this, because this was done without the help of a secretary, as you can see. I am Thurman Smith from Lyons, Oregon, and I'm representing the Oregon State Grange. The Grange supports House Bill 3195. The present situation, as I see it, is that faith in people and ignorance of adverse possession laws have proved costly to too many people. It appears that the adverse possessors depart from the presumption that the land has been abandoned to them and proceed to construct a basis that will write them into title regardless of the facts. Let's say the courts do the best they can with what they have to go on, but in the absence of a clear, concise statute, courts must develop concepts and interpretations. In the realm of adverse possession, confusion in the minds of ordinary people has been increased by the language of the court. Some examples which shake them up out there are the kind of occupancy or use of the land which will satisfy the requirement will vary with the nature of the land. A different yardstick is used in different situations. Another one, possession without hostility, there will not ripen into title. And hostility is not used, this is a quote, hostility is not used in the ordinary dictionary meaning of ill will. But the intention of claiming exclusive title and a denial of title to anyone else. So that was covered by the attorney Another one, even if no evidence of hostile intent exists, there is a presumption of adverse possession where the property is used in the manner that the owner would use it. And the requirement of continuity does not require actual possession every day during the period of limitation. So these get people shook up out there when they're thinking about their property and being nice to their neighbors. Mr. Average Citizen, who bought and paid for and got titled a real property, cannot always discern facts from which the basis of a cause, which form the basis of a cause for action. We cannot properly allege that they knew or should have known. We must have legislation to improve the situation. There are people out there that are just dreaming up ways. I am a real estate broker, and within the past couple of years, there have been two men that came to my office on different occasions and tried to swear me to secrecy before they told me what they wanted. And what they wanted to do was figure out a way they could get this piece of property from old man so-and-so over here. He's got plenty. He doesn't need this. And they could use it. And he's not using it as well as they would use it. And that's what they wanted to know, was how they could get it for nothing. And this is going on out there. And people are succeeding. And we believe that this House bill will definitely improve the situation. And it definitely needs improving. That's one thing. It's broken, needs fixing.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Appreciate your testimony. Are there questions for Mr. Smith? Thank you very much. I don't want to spend the time doing it today, but we'll do it tomorrow if you want to. We'll move into a public hearing on House Bill 2219. Representative Schroeder.
There's a cell name.
Thank you, Chairman Bowman and members of the committee. I'll make this very brief. I'm expecting some others to be here to testify for and against this measure also. I'm State Representative Walt Schroeder, representing Coos and Curry County, District 48. We're talking about Judicial District 15, which is Coos and Curry County, and the state are now being well served under the present organizational structure. The Judicial District has two circuit judges residing in Coos County and working one circuit judge resident in Curry County. These judges share the circuit court load, and in addition, the judge in Curry County presides at trials in other counties in Western Oregon. Curry County also has a district judge. Both the district and circuit judge work closely together and serve as a consolidated court. When one finds it necessary to be out of town or out of the judicial district, they arrange their schedule so that one or the other is almost always in the county, should it be necessary for a warrant to be obtained. I join Senator Bradbury and District Presiding Judge Richard Barron in opposing this bill.
Representative Schroeder, what Representative Clark just pointed out to me correctly, and I think it's helpful for the committee to realize, is that you're testifying on an amendment which has been proposed to House Bill 2219, which substantially changes the impact of the bill as was originally presented.
Yes, that is correct, Madam Chairman.
And the amendment is, I believe, in our package of material. I think it might be helpful, actually, if Representative Calhoun, could you just speak to the amendment and what House Bill 2219 is doing in its current form here?
I think we have some of Representative Schroeder's law enforcement community here today to testify for the bill, and I was basically moving this along through the process to them as a courtesy, and they might be able to speak to the reasons for the proposed amendment. I think that there's 9 of 11 of the trial lawyers in the county that are in favor of it, along with the county commission.
Madam Speaker, where are the proposed amendments? Are they this summary? Is that it?
Yes.
Okay.
That's correct.
Madam Chair, it was the amendment that I was...
Maybe you could respond, Representative Schroeder. I mean, I want to make sure that you have an opportunity to address your concerns at a point where the committee is aware of what the issue is that you're expressing concerns about.
My understanding, Madam Chairman, that the amendment is going to be stuffed into the original bill.
That's correct.
Yeah.
That is the plan.
Madam Chair.
Representative Clark.
I saw people flipping through their files looking at 2219 and talks about adding circuit judges in Multnomah and Washington County. And that was the only reason I raised the issue, because people were looking sort of perplexed.
This was a bill that we tabled without having rules to table in the committee, so it effectively isn't tabled. But I know that Mr. Roberts is here, and he could probably...
I understand that, Representative Calhoun. I wanted to offer you the opportunity to do that. Representative Schroeder, are you going to be able to hang around? Are there questions?
Stay around.
Mm-hmm. It'd be nice to have you stick around for a while.
Madam Chair,
Frank,
whose amendments are these?
We'll find out about that. Frank Roberts.
We'll find out about that.
Madam Chair, committee members, Jim Gardner, who administers the defense contract in Curry County, is also here to talk about this bill. And that's important because he's been an attorney in Curry County for 16 years. I've only been there for a year and a half at this time. At this time, Curry County and Coos County are one judicial district. We have six judges, which are, two of them are in Curry County. We have a district court judge and a circuit court judge there. The district court judge is voted for in Curry County only. The circuit court judge is voted for in Coos and Curry County. Coos County has two district court and two circuit court. I brought up some packets earlier today that I would hope would be presented to members, which...
Maybe you could describe what's in the packet. I suspect you already have them.
I do have some extras here if you don't have them.
Describe what your packet has in it, and then we'll...
Yeah, the first page of it is from... there's, I think, 13 pages. The first page is by the Board of County Commissioners in Curry County, which is a resolution by all three commissioners. That's it. Now, that packet includes seven elected officials in Curry County. The three commissioners who support this bill, the district attorney who supports the bill, the mayors of each city in Curry County, and then nine of the letters are from attorneys who are practicing attorneys in Curry County. We have 14 practicing attorneys in Curry County who practiced before this court, although two of those actually don't practice in the courtroom. So what we've got is 9 out of 12 who are in the courtroom are saying this is something that is needed down in Curry County. At this time, some of the problems that we have are that our bench and bar committee is located in Coos Bay. We're looking at over 100 miles from Brookings for anyone to travel up there and sit down with other attorneys and say, how do we make our judicial process work? That's impossible for most busy attorneys. That would be like having your bar committee up in Portland and driving from Eugene. The attorneys have clearly stated that they would like to elect their own judge, their own circuit court judge in Curry County, have their own bench and bar there, and be able to work together in making it a beneficial process for everybody down there. The reason why I brought this bill in the manner that I did is because in 2 years it'll come back, and the year after that we're facing another election. This would get everybody a chance to realize what they needed to do in Curry County. Now, we're isolated from that court based upon several things. The other thing is that we've got the population in Curry County is 18,400 people. Our population is growing 1,200 people in 1987. We're the fastest growing county in the state of Oregon. We're quickly needing changes there to meet our needs. The Pelican State Prison, which is being built just across the border from Brookings, is going to put several pressures on Curry County, which are going to need to be addressed by a presiding judge in Curry County and by the attorneys in Curry County working together. Our total population between Coos and Curry County is 80,000 people, which means that there is 13,333 people per judge. That gives, if you divide it up, it gives Curry County almost two judges. At this time, our judges can be elected out of Coos County instead of Curry County, and as I stated before, the major concern with us is that we don't have a bench and bar. I would hope that by these letters, this committee recognizes that you're looking at nine attorneys who practice in that courtroom day in and day out, the people who have to deal with it, and those are the people that really know what the problem is down there. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Gardner.
As Mr. Roberts said, I am Jim Gardner. I'm an attorney in Gold Beach. I've been there for 16 years. During that 16 years, I have done private practice as well as public defender work for Curry County and the state of Oregon. The package you have before you, as Mr. Roberts said, indicates the feelings of the people in the county regarding a judicial district, the elected officials, as well as the attorneys. There has been other rumors going around that this is a personality.
The quality of district court judges around the state. In my opinion, the quality of the existing district court bench is, for the most part, on par with the circuit bench. Call any lawyer that you know in Multnomah County. They're trying cases now to district judges sitting as circuit judges. Call any lawyer that you want to call and find out what their experience is. Or call the presiding judge in any of the six counties that I mentioned. Now, I'll make one final point. Even with consolidation, some of today's practices will continue, and I refer to practices such as this. Multnomah County has a juvenile department, and up until recently it was presided over by a district judge, Linda Bergman. It's still presided over by a district judge, by Linda Bergman, but now she's a circuit judge. We're inevitably going to have some specialization in trial courts, whether we have the existing system or whether we have a one-level trial court. And as is always the case, if you have unusually complex or difficult cases, I have no doubt that the presiding judge will assign those cases to the judges most able to handle those cases. People don't change much, but systems change, and when change for the better is achievable, the change should be made. And I'd like to close by saying that there is only one thing that is more inevitable than change, and that is resistance to change. Were I still practicing law, I might well be here arguing for the other point of view, as certainly some estimable witnesses will that will follow me. But I respectfully submit that viewed objectively and dispassionately, the better case is for the passage of House Bill 2342. Now, if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Are there questions? Representative Baum.
Justice Peterson, I noticed that none of your examples had anything to do with judicial districts east of the Cascades. realizing that I may have some unhappy campers out there in my two judicial districts, probably willing to go along, but they have a problem with facilities, and that, Hermiston is concerned that they're going to lose what they have there, and the Grand has two, one with the circuit judge and one with the district court, and one's got a six-person jury room, another one's got a 12, and so some of this isn't going to be practically feasible unless there's money to build facilities to allow it to happen.
Yes, you're Representative Baum, you are, of course, correct. The same situation exists, of course. In a way, I'm glad you asked the question, because you come from a district in which there is complete cooperation between the circuit judge and the district judge, and working together, they can accomplish the same things that we get under 2342, and I'm sure that argument will be made later on today. But in, just to answer your question, obviously those are problems that will have to be faced, and I think we can probably work out our problems with the county so that the district court facilities can be changed to accommodate larger juries.
Other questions with follow-up, Representative?
You've got a grandfather clause in here for circuit judges. Are you late? Consideration in your knowledge about doing the same thing for district court judges that don't want to try a custody disputes?
Yes, there was consideration, and I thought that that was in the bill.
Maybe it is.
It is in the bill, Mr. Linden tells me. Yes.
I have some concerns on that.
Other questions? Representative Calhoun.
I had a question. Do you have a copy of the bill for you?
Yes.
On page 32, there's a little matter in here that I've kind of wondered about for some time, about incumbency or the use of the word incumbent after a candidate's name. And I think what the section does is allows the district court judges to use the word incumbent after their name in circuit court elections. Is that
essentially that's they would become a circuit judge, and this would just continue the law that's now in effect as to district judges when their title changes to circuit judge.
How would you feel about taking that, the use of the word incumbent, out of there altogether?
I would not support that,
Madam Chair.
Representative Mannix.
Wouldn't it be fair to say that the use of the term incumbent there is just as appropriate or inappropriate, which is a separate debate, as it is for someone who's appointed to be able to use the term incumbent right now when they're up for election?
Could you repeat that question?
It's deliberate, the leading questions, and yeah. It's a friendly question.
Yeah.
What I'm getting at is, I am equally concerned about the use of the term incumbent on the ballot, but let's face it, if you're appointed right now, you can use the term incumbent.
Oh, yes.
You just can't use re-elect on
yes,
your,
that's true.
On your
yes.
lawn signs. So saying incumbent for a district judge who's now become a circuit judge through legislation is no different than saying incumbent for someone who got appointed to the circuit court bench.
That's correct.
Thank you.
Other questions? Representative Calhoun, then Representative Edmondson.
I'm really up in the air on this one, so I'm going to ask you a couple of the questions that the advocates on the other side keep trying to point out to me. One of the things that they ask, and maybe you can respond to this, is the question of, can you attract the kind of people you want to sit on the circuit court bench if you're just throwing them into this pool of people that are going to be handling a lot of misdemeanor cases and this type of thing also? So I guess their point is, are you going to get the very well-renowned lawyer that's accustomed to sitting on all the big cases to become a judge if he's going to get stuck down in the basically district court duties?
Representative Calhoun, the answer here to that question is twofold. The first answer is, I don't see us attracting very many, quote, well-renowned lawyers to the bench today as we did in the 60s when we attracted a whole slug of them like Bill Dale and Charlie Crookham and Robert E. Jones. But don't misunderstand me. The quality of people that are filing for office and that are giving their names to the governor as candidates for the district bench are high quality, and that's the reason why I made the point that I made earlier, that the quality of district judges who now are interested in taking the dog court and FED court judges is high, and I respectfully submit that we're not going to have any lesser quality of people attracted to the bench if this bill passes.
Representative Calhoun, and then to Representative Edmondson.
The other one was, would it, since most of our appointments or most of our judges get in initially through appointment, will this exclude younger attorneys from becoming judges since the governor, this is another one of the arguments that are made, would it exclude them since the governor might not be as willing to appoint them to be judges if they're going to sit on more serious matters?
I haven't thought about that question before, Representative Calhoun, and all I can say is I don't think that that would be a negative effect of it.
Is this the last one, Representative Calhoun?
Oh,
we do have a lengthy list of people who are waiting, and I would almost assure you that the questions will be answered. One more, and then I think there's some other people who have questions on the dais.
I'll save this one more for him, and I'll save another one
Thank
for Bill
you.
Linden, because I think maybe he's more appropriate. What practically is going to happen? I've got a county of six judges, three circuit and three district, and I was concerned initially about this bill forcing some of my district court judges that like their work into circuit court. Can you explain to me, there's going to be a presiding judge appointed amongst all the judges rather than one for each of the courts? And what's going to happen then in terms of delegation of duties for those judges?
Number one, one presiding judge will be appointed. Number two, the allocation of duties among the judges will depend on, first of all, whether the judges opt out. If the district judges opt out to remain district judges and the circuit judges remain to opt out to be only to do only, quote, circuit judge work, then that'll pretty much guarantee the perpetuation of the status quo, at least for a period of time in the future. But my guess is that few of your judges will opt out. My guess is that it'll be operated as one court, and every one of the six judges, unless they opt out, will end up doing, quote, district court work, close quotes, and, quote, circuit court work as assigned by the presiding judge.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Clark. Heath.
Okay.
Change his mind.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Justice Peterson, can you tell me a little bit about what other states do? That's always helpful for me to know in terms of, so that we're not reinventing the wheel. Other states, relatively the same size, Colorado, Washington, can't think of New Mexico, perhaps Arizona. I mean, I'm trying to think of the states that I know of, which ones have two-tier trial courts and which ones don't, and why. And
Representative Clark, most states have a two-tiered trial court. That's true of California. That's true, I believe, of Washington. If I may, could I send you a letter, and I'll give you a breakdown state by state?
Sure, that'd be great. And if, you know, more than just the sort of the head count, I'm trying to get some sense for what the experience has been in other states, so that, I mean, if we're going to be out in front, that's great. If we're not out in front and other people have been through this before, let's find out.
No, there are a number of states with one-tier trial courts, but offhand, I apologize.
Okay.
I should have
that's fine.
Gotten that information for
okay.
you.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Chief Justice Joseph.
While he's coming up, I just want to compliment the Chief Justice on that audiovisual display, and I'm going to use that in court the next time. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I have no desire to be facetious. That sometimes overwhelms me. But if Representative Mason ever gets in the mood, he can regale you with stories of what we refer to as the old days on the Judicial Commission, when the plan to merge the trial courts was known as Joseph's Whole Hog Plan, and usually said with a laugh of derision. And I am told by Representative Mason and others that that name, having become attached to it, was the death knell for the plan. I have no desire to kill this, which I have supported now for 10 years. The Chief Justice has presented the case. I think the case is irrefutable. There is no basis on which to oppose the merger except unprovables and emotionals. No, I don't even have to stay here for the rest of the day to hear what the opponents will say. I've heard it before, and what it all comes down to is we don't think those people ought to be elevated to the circuit court. Bull. I have nothing further to say. I'd be happy to answer questions.
Are there questions?
Sound like he's from Eastern Oregon.
Do you really?
What
how do you really feel about this?
How do you really feel about this?
Representative Calhoun.
Judge, what would you think about consolidating the Court of Appeals and Supreme Court?
Representative Mason is here, so I can't deny what my position on that has been. I see no reason for the continued existence of the two-level appellate system in the state of Oregon.
Are there questions? Thank you.
That it?
Appreciate your testimony, your clarity, brevity, wit.
Now I have to talk to the Chief Justice. I liked his audiovisual, too, as a matter of fact.
Bill Linden. Judge Susan Graber. Oh, sorry.
Madam Chair, I apologize. I'm bouncing between three committees this afternoon. For the record, Bill Linden, State Court Administrator. I wanted to talk about three specific issues relating to this bill. First, to give you some examples of benefits that we see from administrative consolidation, which is a component part of the plan we're talking about here. Secondly, to briefly explain the LC 2342-1 amendments that we are proposing, and finally to talk for a moment about fiscal impact issues. Approximately three-quarters of our courts have made substantial progress towards administratively consolidating their operations. And by administration, I'm talking about the clerk's office operations, jury management, calendaring, things of that nature, the support functions that the courts provide to assist the judges in their adjudication responsibilities. We have had staff of my office working with trial courts for the last 2 years in assisting them to administratively consolidate. And we have found that it's a effective method of eliminating unnecessary procedural differences between circuit and district courts. For example, in many of the courts we've worked in, we found that the circuit court and the district court had different procedures for handling warrants. And by combining that function into a single operation, there's a uniform way of handling warrants in a county. And that's an important issue for us because problems in handling warrants result in lawsuits. And we found that that's just one example of a combined function that seems to operate better. It simplifies the training that we have to give new clerks and give clerks on an ongoing basis, because by definition, if we have one way of doing things in a county as opposed to one way in the circuit court and one way in the district court, we have fewer procedures and practices that we have to train the clerks in. We're able to streamline job responsibilities. Instead of having a district court clerk handling civil motions and a circuit court clerk handling civil motions, if we consolidate the civil section of a clerk's office, we have a single clerk handling all the civil motions. It allows us to streamline the way we manage our forms, and courts use an extraordinary number of forms for a variety of functions, and when it's not consolidated, we have forms doing one thing in the circuit court and forms doing the same thing in the district court. There may be very minor differences between the two. This allows us to consolidate completely the forms that are in use in a particular court. It saves a little money. It doesn't save a lot of money, but it gives us more uniformity. We also have many courts that had different case numbering systems. We get in there, we consolidate the file room, and we can consolidate the numbering system, which makes it easier to access and retrieve and replace case files. It allows us to... This bill would allow us to reduce some duplication that we currently have in the felony case file area, where we start a felony case file in the district court side, eventually works its way into the circuit court side, and we start a second file there. One thing that we found that's hard to quantify, but when we have consolidated clerk's office operations, we have been able to break down real divisions in terms of the way the clerks on either the district court or circuit court feel about their counterparts. They've found that they can work together, that there's no need to have a split in terms of I'm a circuit court clerk and I'm a district court clerk and that we're not going to work together. We found that the people work very well together regardless of what court they started out with when we consolidate. We know for a fact that OGIN, our Judicial Information Network, works most efficiently and effectively in an administratively consolidated environment because we're doing the same functions the same way in both the circuit and district court. And OGIN is a system that is basically designed for handling case management and financial management in a court setting as opposed to a circuit court or district court. So where you've got uniform procedures in the circuit and district court, OGIN implementation and use is simply easier. And also, and many counties do this right now, consolidation makes the use of a single jury pool much easier to administer. Right now, the circuit court by statute is charged with the responsibility for calling and basically managing the jury pool. In some counties, we still have separate pools carved out for district court use. Consolidated jury pools that are used by both the circuit and district courts save money and are generally more efficient. We've made great strides in the administrative consolidation area. House Bill 2342 would mandate that all courts be administratively consolidated by the end of this calendar year. And I'm sure that we'd see benefits in the courts that are not yet administratively consolidated, similar to the ones that we've seen in the courts that have accomplished this. Moving to the amendments to House Bill 2342.
Madam Chair, the
LC amendments.
Representative Edmondson.
I just want to stop you before you get off the bill. Would you explain to me the Section 87, the Sections 1 and 2 are repealed September 1, 1993. I take it that's not a sunset clause, but it's simply that those two sections would no longer be necessary?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Edmondson, by September 1, 1993, all of the things that are going to happen under Section 1 and 2 will have happened by then.
So, but you're not proposing an experiment here, in other words.
No, Mr. Representative Edmondson, we're not.
Make that clear.
Yes, thanks. This is not a pilot project.
Thanks.
The amendments to the bill that we're suggesting do two things. Number one, we have inserted language on page 2 of the printed bill. It begins on subsection 3 of section 1 that has to do with the initial implementation of the consolidation bill. The major change there is the original bill read that in effecting consolidation, the Chief Justice can interpret and override statutes that conflict with the purpose of creating a single circuit court. Upon reflection, that we don't want to be in the business of overriding statutes. And that language in the amendments would change to say that the Chief Justice shall interpret statutes in such a way as to be compatible with trial court consolidation policy, and where the Chief Justice identifies statutes that are in conflict with this policy, the Chief shall cause legislation to be filed at the next regular session to correct that. The balance of the amendments primarily deal with maintaining the current status quo for residency requirements for sitting judges, both circuit and district, and how they would be elected. And again, the goal here is to maintain the status quo so that judges who are currently sitting are not adversely affected by changes in how or in what geographic district they would need to be elected from.
Yes, Representative Mannix.
On that point, I note that page 2 of the proposed amendments, when you're using current language, each judge shall be a resident of or have principal office in the judicial district. By principal office, I assume you're referring to the judicial office.
Correct.
So, now you have your judicial office there. You've taken care of your residency requirements.
Correct.
Why do we even bother talking about residency requirements then, other than having your judicial office there? I'm taking you too far afield. It goes beyond what we're really talking about, but I didn't understand why you went to so much trouble to plug that back in.
Madam Chair, Representative Mannix, that was existing language. I'd have to go back and see what the original reason for
it. I won't fool with it. I just noticed that. That's all.
I don't believe the principal office language was meant to refer to a lawyer who is not yet a judge, but perhaps it was. Oh, okay. Madam Chair, Representative Mannix, Judge Joseph just helped me out on this. It refers to time of election, so you're a resident or an appointed judge and have your resident office or have your principal office. I, be, I hope I got that straight.
Thank you.
I'm confused. The point that you're making is this is for the purpose of running only, or that a judge who, without the language that Representative Mannix pointed to, every sitting judge's principal office is obviously in the county where that judge is a sitting judge. After once elected, a judge is free to move if he or she wishes and live wherever, in or out of the county. This is only a residency for the purpose of being a candidate. Is that?
Madam Chair, I am not absolutely certain if that is how this would be interpreted.
Is that the intent?
Well, we're not suggesting to amend this language, and I'm not sure what the original intent was.
Okay.
May I follow up on that?
Representative Mannix.
I think that's the most legitimate point, is we're not fooling around with the concept. We may want to someday, but we'll just leave it alone for now.
Or I'd be happy to try and track down the legislative history on it.
We'll talk about it next session if we're still here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This bill, if passed with the amendments, would not, in my opinion, result in any kind of a significant fiscal impact. I don't represent this as a measure that would save us money. It will allow us to make better use of existing resources, both staff and judge resources, but it is not a big money saver. There would be some minor costs involved in reprogramming a computer system to eliminate references to district court and things of that nature, but I would argue that the subsequent referral on this bill is not really necessary in terms of the minimal costs that we'd absorb just by making those kind of terminology changes. And then the last point I wanted to make, I know we have a lot of witnesses, is the earlier question Representative Baum posed about the opt-out provision that's on page 2. I thought you were referring to circuit court. There is a provision in there for a circuit judge to opt out. There is no provision for a district judge to opt out, but the proponents have no objection to that being added as a friendly amendment. And that would cover a situation where a district judge decided he or she did not want to hear what are commonly referred to as circuit court cases. Madam Chair, I'll be happy trying to respond to questions.
Are there questions for Mr. Linden, Representative Calhoun?
I'm confused on this election thing. What's the current requirement for residency for elections of judges?
Madam Chair, Representative Calhoun, with the exception of Multnomah County, there's an exception for Multnomah County that puts it on different status from other counties. That is that a judge from a county with a judicial district with a population of 500,000 or more, the judges of the circuit court in that county may reside within 10 miles of the boundary of the district. And that's to accommodate the reality that the Portland metropolitan area is an urban metropolitan area, and judges serving in the Multnomah County Circuit Court have and some continue to reside outside of Multnomah County, but within the 10 miles of the county line. I don't know the legislative history on the language of a resident of or have principal office in the judicial district. I believe what it means is you're either a resident or if you're appointed, you have your principal office in the district. I think the or principal office in the district relates to time of election as opposed to any other factor, but I'm not absolutely certain. And this bill does not change that. That's existing language.
I would like to ask you about a couple of other amendments. I understand most of the amendments that you've proposed, but if you would look at page 2 of the bill, your amendments propose to take out the sentence at the end of line 30 and on all of line 31, the merger accomplished by this act does not require any discontinuation of such justice courts. I'm just concerned, is there a hint there that there is some discontinuation or, you know, there's a negative pregnant, I think is what we refer to here.
Madam Chair, Representative Mannix, it was taken out because it didn't need to be in there in the first place. We were not attempting to affect the district, the justice courts, and It was just surplus language. It didn't do anything one way or the other.
One other, Madam Chair? Find my question marks. Okay. Page 8 of the bill, lines 7 and 8, you propose to amend the bill by deleting those lines, and I didn't immediately discern why we should delete those. Could you explain that? Any powers described in this section that were exercised by a district court in the county before the operative date of Section 2 of this 1989 Act? It's talking about the jurisdiction.
Yeah.
Other, I'm sorry.
I'm
are we waiting for an answer?
Yes, we are. Madam Chair, Representative Mannix.
No, no, right now, that's all right. I just couldn't
I'm drawing
out.
A blank, and I apologize for that, but I will get you that answer. It's there for a reason. It's coming out for a reason.
All right. Thank you. I have no further questions.
Thank you, Representative Mannix. Representative Calhoun.
I just picked something out of the amendments, and I'm kind of wondering what the effect of it is. We had the earlier testimony from down from my area about Coos and Curry County and the splitting of those districts. And apparently, as part of the amendment, you've got two judges who reside in Curry County and four that reside in Coos County. What's the effect of that going to be in terms of how they're elected, or will it have any effect?
Madam Chair, Representative Calhoun, that it will have no effect on, for example, Judge Downer will still run in the two counties that he currently runs in. It will have no effect. The intent of the amendments on how the judges in different counties get elected is to maintain the status quo.
If I can follow up on that, Madam Chair, wouldn't this in fact take away Curry County's district court judge, because it seems that in the bill it's making six judges elected by Coos in Curry County, so they wouldn't be able to autonomously elect their own district court judge. Is that right?
Am Madam Chair, Representative Calhoun, that would happen to all the district judges. There would still be six judges in that judicial district. They'd all be circuit judges as opposed to three circuit and three districts. And all the district judges right now run in a specific county, with the exception of Judge Valentine, who runs in Union and Wallowa counties, and Judge Nielsen, who runs in Jefferson and Crook counties. Those are the only two that run in multiple counties right now.
That's Curry County loses their district court judge.
Madam Chair, Representative Calhoun, loses a district judge and gains a circuit judge. Same person. He'd just become a circuit judge as opposed to a district judge.
He'll still be elected exclusively by Curry County or by both counties then?
Madam Chair, Representative Calhoun, by both counties. The circuit judges right now are elected judicial district-wide as opposed to just on a county-by-county basis.
Thank you.